This conversation between Bing Devine and Walter Langford is being taped in Bing's home in St. Louis on December 9th, 1987.
Are you a native St. Louis?
Yes, I was born in Overland, Missouri.
That's not too far away, the other side of the state.
At that time, no, Overland, St. Louis County.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, that's where Rittner High School. Rittner High School is. No, that's Overland Park you're thinking of.
Yeah.
Overland is where Rittner High School is located, and at that time it was country. Now it's part of course, the greater St. Louis area.
But
sure. I wasn't really brought up on a farm, but we lived in a house that was, there were only about a half a dozen houses within several miles.
It's hard to find these days around the metropolitan
that's
area.
Right.
And that was
1916.
So, were you a ball player in your younger days?
Well, I had great aspirations to become a ball player. I played ball at in the old Trolley League, incidentally, here, which at one time the one of the fine. This is, you know, times have changed, but at that time, semi-pro ball was a big thing in the St. Louis
yes.
area. A lot of ball players came out of professional ball players, major league ball players came
sure.
out of semi-pro ball. Terry Moore was about as good an example as there is. And I played in the league I played in, known as the Trolley League, was the outstanding team in that league that was well known, certainly in the Midwest, for its baseball ability. It was a team by the name of the Belleville Stags.
Mm-hmm.
It was all the same league, called the Trolley League, and that was one of quite a few teams I played on. I played semi-pro ball, sometimes several nights a week, evenings a week.
Yeah.
There wasn't any night baseball.
No.
And I played baseball at University City High School for a coach by the name of George Thompson, who incidentally is still alive. And I played baseball at Washington University.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came out of there, I again continued to play semi-pro ball and was made contact in a very unusual way with the baseball Cardinals and went to a tryout camp at Old Sportsman's Park
yeah.
and was hired really to be an office boy and a runner around the ballpark, still thinking I could play ball. Ray Blades was the manager of the club in 1939 and 40, and I was, while I was doing my job, I asked him if I could work out with the team, and he let me, and eventually I became one of his primary batting practice pitchers against against the great, some of the great Cardinal hitters. Medwick
yeah.
would have been one of them.
Yeah.
And that's where I learned that when I look back upon that, I realize that you have a completely different aspect of things when you're young and when you're older, because in those days we pitched batting practice without any screens. No batting practice screens. So you were out there, you were
sitting duck.
You were a great target for some
mm-hmm.
of the hitters, some of whom like to hit the ball back through the box to see if they could hit you.
Yeah.
And and now that I look at it and see the screens, and in fact, I pitched later just for the fun of it, pitched some batting practice with screens, and I wonder how in the world I stood out there with nothing in front of me.
That's right. That's right. We wonder about a lot of things we did in our younger
and
days.
Then I went out and played 1 year of minor league baseball at Johnson City, Tennessee, which is where I met my wife, incidentally.
Uh-huh. Wow. You had a good background for all that you got into later.
Yeah, I played more. The game I played the best was basketball. I was a fine basketball player, if I say so myself.
You would be tall in your day.
That's right. Well, I wasn't tall, but there weren't too many people that were much larger.
Yeah.
If you had a man 6'4" or 5" on your team, you were in control pretty
giant.
Much of the situation.
Yeah.
And I played basketball at Washington University and then played what was called AAU ball, Amateur Athletic Union ball, around the city, and went to several Denver tournaments, which was the big climax of a basketball season before the days of pro ball.
Yeah. You must have been in at Washington more or less in the 40s?
I was at Washington in the 30s. I graduated in 1938.
Yeah, well, about that time, a year or two later, I took over as a fencing coach in Notre Dame and was tennis coach for 15 years too, each of them. And I remember one of our earliest trips under my guidance was down to meet Washington University. They had a really fine fencer named Baker. Anyway.
We played basketball in those days They played basketball and football. Washington, at that time, Jim Konzelman was the coach and athletic director and was developing quite an outstanding top-level football program at Washington University, which eventually died of its... The administration didn't want that kind of a program. It died and Konzelman left. But they played Notre Dame in football, and we played Notre Dame in basketball. In fact, the very first game, I didn't play in high school, didn't play basketball in high school. And when I went to Washington University and became played basketball, it was the coach that eventually gave me a chance to play a lot was Hudson Helmick, who was a fine athlete at the University of Illinois. And he came in as basketball coach and immediately gave me a chance to start as a sophomore. And I really, except for church ball and AE, I never had played ball in front of an organized game in front of a big crowd. And the first game of that type I ever played was when I started against Notre Dame out of the old field house. And as I think back now...
We went to the old field house for our fencing meet.
As I think back now, I was frightened. I was scared to death.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, between between your minor league year and when you became general manager of the Cardinals, what were you doing?
Mostly, I tried to play the 1 year, did play, and discovered that the scouts were right. I couldn't play. It wasn't going to be much of a career. So they kept me in the organization. At that time, the teams owned their own minor league club.
Yeah.
They operated, they not only supplied the players, but they supplied the administrative personnel. Not many at the lower levels, just a business manager and a concession manager.
Yeah.
That was it. And so since they still owned the teams at that time, I became the general manager, business manager, they called them then at the lower levels. Actually, it was the equivalent of what nowadays is called a general manager at Fresno, California, and Decatur, Illinois. That was in the early 40s, and then I went in the service and served with 3 years in the Navy. Came back out, immediately went back in the Cardinal organization at Columbus, Georgia.
Yeah.
And was general manager there for 2 years. That was at that time, an A league by the name of the Sally League.
Yeah, sure.
And I went from Columbus, Georgia to St. Louis, as a matter of fact. Sam Braden, who still owned the team, brought me into St. Louis to kind of be an ambassador of goodwill, I guess. I don't remember what title they were going to bestow upon me. And I was sent on a quick trip to the Cardinal West Coast, Western, I guess, owner clubs. This was in the off-season. This was in the winter, really. But they wanted to establish some rapport with their minor league teams, and I was called upon to make this trip to, as I recall, Pocatello, Idaho, Fresno, California, Sacramento, California, four or five places.
Yeah.
And when I came back from the trip, came into the Union Station, everybody was still traveling by train at that time, I caught a cab home. And in the cab, picked up a newspaper and started to read it, and the headline said, Sam Braden close to selling Cardinals. I just come here to work for him, although this was my home originally, so there wasn't any great upset. And now there was a question of who was going to own the team. And at that time, he did sell the team then. He sold it to a couple, really, Bob Hannigan and Fred Saab. Bob Hannigan kept me on as his public relations director and stayed here a year and then was sent to Rochester as the general manager. About the time that happened, Fred Tsai bought out Hannigan so that Fred Tsai owned the club by himself. Frankly talked to me and wanted me to stay in St. Louis and work for him. And rather than go to Rochester, which was the Cardinals AAA club, I said, I really look forward to operating my own club at the top level of the major league. And we've already announced it, and I've made a preliminary trip up there, and I think I'd like to stay with it. And so I went to Rochester as the general manager and stayed there for 6 years, 49 through 55.
Very good.
49 through 54. Mm-hmm. And then came to St. Louis as Dick Meyer, who was Mr. Bush's right-hand man at the Anheuser-Busch at the time, had taken a liking to me at Rochester and asked me to come into St. Louis and work as assistant general manager, I guess. Because he had been doing that job and wanted to move back to the borough. He didn't like the limelight. He wanted to do his executive work at Anheuser-Busch. I think they had in mind my taking over immediately. Mr. Bush ran into somebody that recommended Frank Lane to him. He hired Frank Lane as the general manager, and Frank Lane kept me as his assistant. That had stayed for 2 years, and then when Frank Lane left to go to Cleveland, Mr. Bush appointed me the general manager, and that was in late 1957.
All right. That was an interesting path up to the top.
Well, really about like a ball player. In those
yeah,
days you went.
That's right.
See, they, at that time they used to have class D, C, B, and A.
I know.
Now they only have A as a minor,
yeah,
lower minor league.
Yeah.
So a ball player very generally progressed almost in, let's say, 5 years from from D to maybe C or B, and then to A, and then to double A, and then to triple A, and then to the major leagues. They progressed slower than they do now.
Much slower, and probably, according to the old-timers I talked with, probably it is better.
Well, it was in some ways. Let's face it, though, there was very little instruction. You know, there was no
that's true.
They got
experience, but by doing rather than by learning.
Now, maybe that's not bad. But again, it really doesn't make any difference because you're not going to turn the clock back.
No, absolutely not.
But the whole thing was, as I say, my progress really pretty much followed. If I'd have been a ball player and been capable of producing at each level, I'd have made about the same kind of a movement.
True. Yeah. As I say, your experience is more in baseball, a little greater than mine in the playing end. But I got along to semi-pro ball and had an offer to be in class D ball down in Texas. I was raised on the Mexican border of Texas. And I was working in a bank at that time, thought I was going to be a banker, and the bank paid me more money than the team would, so I stayed. But I know I made the right decision because it became evident as another 2 or 3 years of semi-pro ball went on that when some killjoy invented the curveball, he did me a there have been a lot of them that have had that fate, I'm afraid. Anyway, I saw my, as a matter of fact, saw my first Major League Baseball game here in St. Louis on Sportsman's Park. I was going up to Notre Dame to be a freshman in 1926, arranged my train schedules that I got in here in the early afternoon and left about dark and went out and saw the Browns play the Tigers and saw Ty Cobb and George Sisler and a bunch of other great stars, and it was a thrill.
That's the first year that I really remember much about baseball, the year the Cardinals won the pennant in the World Series.
Yeah.
My dad was a great baseball fan, a great sports fan, and incidentally quite an athlete in his day.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Cardinal fan. Mm-hmm. At that time, you had to be a Cardinal or Browns fan.
Oh, sure.
The Browns fans were numerous to appearance, but they never showed up much at the ballpark. But he was a Cardinal fan. I became a Cardinal fan as a result. And I do remember, you know, recalling some of the things that were going on and happening during that first pennant and World Series.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, well, I was about the same age when I became excited about Major League Baseball and the World Series, 1917 and 18. Mm-hmm. I was born in 08, so I had 8 years ahead of head start on you. Now then, 57, you took over as general manager.
After, it was late, see, it was in fall.
So they didn't win their next pennant until 64, as I remember.
64, that's right.
So you made the famous trade.
The Brock trade?
Yeah.
Yeah, I made that in 64. And then most interesting thing, probably about 64, when you're telling my history, tying it in with baseball, is the fact that 64 is the year that in August, Mr. Bush became frustrated, disturbed about not winning, as you say, since I'd taken over. So he decided to make a change, and he fired me, if you want, separated me, whatever the proper word is, in August of 1964. And like 6 weeks later, the Cardinals went on to win the pennant in the World Series. And that at that point, at that time, that was quite a story.
Sure.
I added Brock was one. Well, the whole team was people that I put together. Most of them traded for, incidentally.
Well, that's
and,
all the more to your credit.
And the other player that had a great deal to do with the Cardinals winning the pennant and the World Series was a pitcher that I had acquired from the Cubs and had in the minor leagues and had just brought up before I left. And that was Barney Schultz, the knuckleball pitcher.
Yeah, yeah. I would guess that there aren't many trades in Major League Baseball that are better known and more lopsided than the Brock Fabroglio trade. Probably not. It was a six-player drain, incidentally. We added players.
The others never
met. No, we added players to compensate for the losses. Like when they lost Brock, they said, well, we need an outfielder back, and we gave him a young outfielder by the name of Doug Clemens. Mm-hmm. And we said, since we're getting rid of Broglio, we need a pitcher and so forth. But Brock, it was not a well-accepted trade publicly, and particularly in the media.
Broglio had won 20 the year
before. Broglio had won 20. And a lot of people, there's always been the speculation since, not necessarily accusation or suspicion. Yeah, I guess suspicion. But I knew that Broglio had something wrong with him when I traded him, which is absolutely untrue.
That was going to be my next question.
No, we had to meet and discuss it quite often. The way it came up, we had been talking about Brock. Johnny Keene was the manager of the club. Mm-hmm. And Keene and I were very close. He had managed for me at Rochester, and we'd been in the organization together for years. And we had the type of relationship that a general manager and a manager needs. We respected each other, we trusted each other, and we both had a common goal, was to win, do the best we could, and eventually win a pennant. And we had talked about Brock in the offseason the year before. That would have been 1963. Mm-hmm. And the Cubs had said, no questions asked, they weren't going to get rid of Brock. So we really forgot about it, although he was one of the players on our want list, wish list. And just before the trading deadline in 64, John Holland, who was then general manager of the Cubs, now passed away, called me and said, well, we're in desperate straits, we need a pitcher, and you've always been interested in Brock, and we might be willing to make a trade of an outfielder Brock for a pitcher. And I said, well, it depends on what pitcher you're talking about. He said, well, you've mentioned several names in passing as we've talked. He said, I guess we'd take Broglio. We might have to enlarge the deal, but we'd take Broglio. Mm-hmm. So we were on a West Coast trip, and I was in Dodger Stadium. I remember distinctly we played an afternoon game at Dodger Stadium, and we're leaving after the game and going to Houston to open a series in Houston. And Keene and I got together on the plane. This really happened in the ballpark at Dodger Stadium after the game when I was talking to Holland on the telephone. I had an hour to do nothing, so I went to payphone and made some calls because it was getting close to trading deadline, which then meant a lot. June 15th doesn't mean much anymore. You make trades almost any time during the year now.
Seems like it.
And so I got Keene and I were on the plane together, sitting in a front seat next to each other, and I leaned over and I said, well, it looks like, and we'd been playing badly and played a very bad game in Dodger Stadium, and John was down about it and very morose, really, didn't want to talk too much. And I said, we need to talk. We got a chance to make a deal, it appears, and between here and Houston, we'll have to discuss it and see what you want to do. And I told him what it was, and he said, well, I remember distinctly, his almost exact words were, well, what are we waiting for? Mm-hmm. I said, well, on that basis, we don't have a lot to talk about, because that's obvious you want to do it. Now, what are we waiting for? We have to wait till the plane gets to Houston.
Right.
We didn't get there till late at night. So I waited until the next morning, called John Holland, that's when we put the deal together.
Mm-hmm. Did Broglio's sore arm show up as soon as he got to Chicago, or was there a lapse?
I think there was some, I think almost immediately there was some, he didn't appear to them to be the same pitcher that they thought he was, although he'd been starting regularly for us, and he was one of our best pitchers. It wasn't anything immediate, but it was something that began to creep into the picture, a discussion of,
sure,
looks like there's something wrong, he's not the pitcher he used to be, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't old, he was a young pitcher.
Oh, he was a young guy, that's right. Only other trade I can think of that was about as favorable for one side and unfavorable of the other was White Sox getting Billy Pierce for Aaron Robinson.
Yeah, well, I don't remember the trade, but I know, I know I remember Billy Pierce very well.
Well, that's what it was. All right, so you took over in 57, you won the pennant in 64, and
again, went to the Mets, 65, 6, and 7.
You were with the Mets in 5, 6, 7?
Yeah. In fact, I was president of the Mets in 1967.
Yeah, I remember that you'd been president of the Mets.
In fact, we were putting together the team that, surprisingly, to everybody, including the people in New York, I mean, the baseball people in New York, they didn't expect that to happen that soon. 2 years after I left, they won the pennant of the World Series there in 1969.
Yeah. And you certainly had to bring in a lot of those players.
Well, a couple of the more important ones was Seaver. I had a definite hand in bringing Seaver to the team.
Great.
And then I made a deal. I had a deal made when I left to come back to St. Louis, because Mr. Dick Meyer, again, had always been a great supporter of mine. And when Musial had been the general manager in 67, the Cardinals won the pennant in the World Series. Mm-hmm. And Musial, who was always one to make a proper decision, decided that was a good time to go out. He didn't want to do that job. And they needed a general manager. And Mr. Dick Meyer suggested to Bush that I might be interested in coming back to St. Louis, since, pardon me, my family had never moved from here. I commuted with for 3 years. And would he be agreeable to discuss bringing me back, which he did, and I didn't plan to leave the Mets. I planned to stay there for a long time. But when I did have the opportunity to come back here, I did not have a contract with the Mets, by their choice, incidentally. So I felt free to talk here, although they received permission from the Mets to talk to me, and I came back here then in 58. I mean, in 68, and we won the pennant, had the World Series, won 3-1, and then lost the last three games. And then the Mets came along to win. The other player, as I left the Mets, I had a deal made with Eddie Stanky, who was then the manager of the Chicago White Sox.
For Agee?
For Tommy Agee. Yeah. And when I left, I told Stanky, it was just before the baseball meeting, and I told Stanky, I said, this deal, you know, we've agreed on this deal, but I'm going to leave the Cardinals confidentially. I'm going to leave the Mets confidentially, going back to the Cardinals. And I think that I'd like to have you delay this deal and let whomever the new man is make a decision if he wants to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed to that. He said, well, how long do you think we have to wait? I said, this is all going to happen within the next week. So he said, well, we'll wait that long. And then I turned over to John Murphy, who was obviously in the conversations with me.
Yeah.
I said, it's your decision. We have the deals there to make. I think it's a good deal, but you make the decision what you want to do. And he went ahead and made the deal.
Who did trade to the Sox for Agee?
Well, I can't remember. Let me go back. I can go get the book.
No, don't worry.
I can.
I can find it in the book, too.
I know another player. Another player we got in the deal was Weiss, Al Weiss.
Yeah.
It was not a bad-looking infield.
They both had a great series in 69.
I can't remember. Now that you mention it, I'm interested in finding out.
All right. I saw Agee and Weiss, to a lesser degree, play a lot. I was a White Sox fan living in South Bend. I went up there often, and I was fond of Agee from the day he first hit there, and he showed me some remarkable outfield play and everything.
Yeah.
So anyway, now... you came back in 68, was your first year back. That was a tough one to lose.
Yeah.
It was, even you were still in it until the eighth inning, as I remember, seventh or eighth inning of the last game.
It was a tie game.
Yeah.
And then Flood kind of misjudged the ball, slipped really. Slipped as he tried to go back on the ball in the outfield. The pictures definitely show that.
So. That did it.
And the ball went over his head and drove in the winning run.
Aside from that game, Gibson would have had one of the most remarkable World Series records, all told, of any pitcher. Wasn't that the only game he lost in the World Series?
Yeah. Also, we probably would have won it 4-1. We had a big lead in Detroit. And the famous play, though, by, you know, this is not the reason, one reason you never lose a game basically on one play.
Well, you can, but it's not
common. Rock didn't slide at the plate.
Oh,
he made a decision to go in standing up and was out at the plate. And at the time we had a lead. We had a pretty big lead. That would have just been more. And then they came back late in the game. It had been a rainy day. And they came back late in the game and won the game.
Yeah. I'm looking at the wrong season.
What are you looking for?
I'm just looking for that game. 68. First game, Gibson beat McLean easily. Second game, Molich beat Bryles. Third game, that was maybe the one you were talking about. You were leading 4-2.
No, it was the fifth game.
Fifth game, all right.
It was a score of like 8-6 or 9-6 or something like that.
Well, the fifth game, they won 5-3. This other game, third game, they won, you won 7-3.
It was the fifth game. It may have been that the score wasn't as big as I thought it was, but that's the game that Brock didn't slide at the play. What was the score in that game?
Innings,
what was the
score? Cardinals got 3 in the first, Detroit 2 in the fourth, and Detroit 3 in the seventh.
Mm-hmm. So, well, see, in between that somewhere, Brock didn't slide at the plate. Didn't slide on a play at the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And their big catcher freehand kind of decoyed him.
Yeah.
And, you know, didn't act like he received the ball. He had the plate blocked, and Brock went in standing up, and they tagged him on a very bang-bang play even at that.
It's fifth inning. Bryles struck out. Brock doubled. Javier singled to left, but Brock was out at the plate. Horton to freehand.
That's the play.
Yep.
Yeah, a lot of people look back. That would have made the score. We'd have had another run and still been playing in what might have been a bigger inning.
Yep.
However, I don't think you looked at those things happen.
Yeah. Now, we're taking over at 68. How long did you stay as the general manager?
Through 78.
78.
Yeah.
Well,
we almost, very few people remember what you almost did and you didn't do. And you'll have to look it up. It's either 73-4 or 74-5. We finished, we missed winning the pennant on the last day of each season. Not many people remember that.
No.
One of the years was 74, I guess, was the year the Mets won. In fact, they had to play. What's that?
73 was when the Mets won.
Okay, well, then that's when it was.
Yeah.
It was 73-4 then. We missed on the last day of each season.
Mets, National League, St. Louis. Yeah, 1.5 games you finished back.
All right.
Yeah.
They had to play. They were rained out in Chicago on Sunday. And they had to play a doubleheader in Chicago on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
If they had lost both games, we'd have been tied and had to have a playoff.
Uh-huh. And the following year, 74, you also were 1.5 back to Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Both years went down to the last day, and we lost out. I don't know that any team has had that bad of an experience for 2 years in succession.
A number of them had it 1 year, but not two in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you had some remarkably fine memories and experiences and seasons and players in those years.
The last deal I made in 78 before I left was, and I'll tell you another interesting angle, was the George Hendrick deal.
For whom?
For Eric Rasmussen, which was, as it turned out, quite one-sided. Hendrick was a productive player for several years.
Yeah.
The only problem with Hendrick was, which I didn't consider a problem as far as acquiring a ball player that could help you, was the fact he didn't talk to the media. The media didn't particularly like it. But since that time, or after he came here and produced, they didn't particularly like it, but they stopped worrying about it and writing about it very much. But the interesting thing is, in 78, Mr. Bush made the decision at that time to get rid of me. And actually, he did offer me to stay at that point as a consultant. And I never had liked the term consultant. So I said, no, I'd just as soon go out and see what I could do elsewhere. I appreciate it. Would you fulfill my contract? And he said yes, and so I left. I had gone to the baseball meeting. This happened really right after the baseball meeting. I came back from the baseball meetings with a deal that I think could have been made. You know, you never know for sure to actually make a deal. But Wuzzy Bavezzi, who was at the Angels at the time, had talked to me about a deal where we would give up Gary Templeton. This was before he was traded to San Diego.
Sure.
For Frank Tanana and Dickie Thom. And I came back to talk to Mr. Bush about the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Bush, very soon after I got back, he called me down to the brewery before we ever had a chance to discuss deals and whether we should make them or not make them, or whether we should go ahead and try to make them or not. So I called Bavezzi, I remember, and said, well, you know, whatever we've talked about is off because I'm out and somebody else is going to take over.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about that, if you think about it, and I told Ozzie Smith the other day at a dinner, I sat next to him and I said, you don't know this, you've never heard it, I haven't talked about it much, but I'm going to tell you the story. And I just told him that story and I said, the interesting thing about that is, that if we had made that deal, you never would have been a Cardinal, because they wouldn't have had Gary Templeton to trade to San Diego for you.
Yeah,
and Dickie Thon, incidentally, wouldn't have, he'd have been somewhere else. He wouldn't have been in Houston.
Wouldn't have been
hit in the head.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And, you know, and really, I thought about, there's others I've thought about, not as dramatic as that, about the fact that what would have happened if this hadn't been done.
Oh, we all do some of that, yeah.
I mean, it could have changed, wouldn't change the course of history as far as history books, but as far as baseball history goes, some of those things would have changed the course of history a great deal.
Sure. I was in, I've only been here in St. Louis for a year and a half, my wife and I. We were living in San Diego for about 6 years and loved every second of it and every inch of it, but between us we have 7 children and 18 grandchildren, and nearly all of them in the Midwest and East. So, and they got jobs and they got kids in school, and so they weren't coming out there, and we were coming over here all the time, spending time, money, and everything else, and decided we got to get back to the Midwest. So we weren't going back to South Bend, where we'd spent 50 years, each of us, and those winters are brutal over there. And we'd come through here very often, and my wife has a son who's a doctor in Barnes and ear, nose, and throat, so we knew St. Louis fairly well, and we said, that's it, that's for us, and so we came in. But I saw Ozzy in some of his earlier years there in San Diego, and he was a wizard even then.
Yeah.
But has become much better, and the way he...
Well, he's become a better hitter.
Oh, the way he raised his hitting this past year was remarkable. Now, after 78, what were you doing?
78, I went with the San Francisco Giants briefly as a, I don't recall the title again, but as I guess a special assistant to the general manager, and did mostly a player evaluation within and out of their organization.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the season, 1978, Bill Bidwell, who's owner of the football Cardinals, called me and asked to make a date with me. We had known each other, but we'd never spent much time together.
Yeah.
And said he needed somebody to take over his administration, vice president of administration, public relations, and wanted to know if I was interested in coming back to St. Louis in that capacity. And I was traveling a great deal with San Francisco, which I didn't mind. But my, again, commuting, my family stayed here.
Yeah.
So I said yes, and I took that job and became vice president of administration of football Cardinals for a couple of years.
Hmm.
And then Montreal, this would have been 78, that would have been 79. And then I was in that job, 79, 80, and part of 81.
Mm-hmm.
And then John McHale. From whom I had turned down a job some years previous when I was still general manager of the Cardinals. He had gotten permission to talk to me and wanted to bring me into Montreal as a general manager under him and on a 5-year contract, incidentally.
Oh, boy.
And I rejected it again on the theory that I'd have to move or commute again or whatever.
Right.
And so, but he at this point needed somebody to run, Jim Fanning had just been manager of the team, needed somebody to run their minor league organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. About a season.
Yeah.
And then again, Bill Bidwell came back to me and said, well, I've just lost my general manager, and which the term general manager with the football Cardinals doesn't mean the same thing it does with a baseball team, because Bidwell's an everyday on-the-scene operator, but he wanted to bring me back in then as president of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back again in that capacity and kept that from the middle of 82 through 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Through 85.
Yeah.
Through 85.
Well, now that you're into indoor soccer, you're an all-sportsman.
I've made almost all of them. And played basketball. Probably the game I played the best was basketball. We don't have an NBA team here, so I don't guess I'll make that.
They did have an NBA team a long time ago.
Yeah, they had one.
Yeah.
A couple of them, as a matter of fact.
Pettit and others. I saw a great deal of the indoor soccer in San Diego with the Soccers, and they're something to watch, all right.
Yeah. This was the prototype team in the MISL, you know, at one time, originally.
Oh.
Everybody, the St. Louis team, back in the early 80s.
I guess I read that.
Ben Kerner, who owned the Hawks that you're just talking about, and Stan Musial owned the team. Did you know that Musial was in the middle?
Didn't know that.
He was one of the, there were several owners, but Kerner and Musial were the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they drew in those days $16,000, $17,000, $18,000 a game.
That's fantastic.
And really, and played all local talent, because St. Louis is a hotbed of soccer,
youth soccer. Yeah.
They played all local talent, and I just remember this, and I've heard more about it since I've gotten back into it. I knew what was going on, knew what it was about, went to a couple games, but that's all. The only game I never played at all when I was younger was soccer.
Yeah.
And but what happened was that the rest of the league immediately recognized they'd have to do something to bring their level up to St. Louis. So they went out and got some foreign-born players, soccer players.
Yeah.
And eventually the teams became better than St. Louis. Whereas St. Louis was dominant in the early 80s, by 1987, 86-87 season last year, St. Louis had become one of the lower four or five teams. There were about a half a dozen teams that were doing better than St. Louis in every respect, playing better, winning more, more competitive, and drawing more. So St. Louis went from one end of the spectrum to the other end.
That's too bad. Do I remember seeing that in the first game or one of the early games this season you had 17,000?
We had 15,000 was our biggest crowd.
What does it hold?
The arena now holds about 19,000. You can get 19,000.
You've been averaging close to 10,000.
Yeah, it's coming back. And a lot depends on how good the team is. The team got off to a good start. They were 4-2, and then they've lost four of their last five, I guess it is.
Yeah.
So they're 5-6 at the moment. Yeah. They're a different type team completely. They're a mixture now of American players and foreign players.
Yeah.
And I think they're probably pretty good. They're young and fast. And not making really my own judgment, because I don't claim to be a soccer expert. But the people that do know seem to think it's a better team, very definitely, than it was the last couple of years.
That's
and that it will compete.
Yeah.
Probably isn't the best team in the league, but it'll compete.
Mm-hmm. And ought to get better.
Hopefully.
Yeah, well, the Sockers, with all their success, didn't average, I don't think, 9,000.
Yeah.
Their arena doesn't hold more than 13, something like that. All right. Now, has the concept of general manager in the major leagues undergone much change in the last decade or two?
Yeah, an extreme change. Going back to my early days as a general manager, and really about the first half of the last tour of duty with the Cardinals in the 70s, a general manager really did everything. He not only was responsible for the team on the field and the signing and the development of the players, but he was actively directed the marketing and the public relations and the entire operation. He was really a chief operating officer.
Yeah.
If you want to deal with Mr. Bush all the time as a chief executive officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely changed. There are very few general managers that pursue all of those duties anymore. And it's logical, because the whole thing has become so complex, complicated, particularly the player contracts, the collective bargaining agreement has changed the whole picture. And in the latter years in St. Louis in the late 70s, I really, by my own choice, suggested to Mr. Bush that we begin to make that kind of a transition. And Joe McShane took over as the vice president of administration. It was a transition because he depended on me quite a bit while he was developing the administrative side of the operation, and I was trying to concentrate on the player side.
Yeah.
Now, that has happened to most general managers in most organizations since.
True. You have a feeling that a former major leaguer is apt to make a good general manager?
I don't think there's any reason he can't make one. I don't think that just because he was a former major league ball player, whether he was a star or whatever kind of a player he was, would automatically make him a good general manager. But I see no reason why he couldn't.
Yeah.
But he can't.
There are a number of them that are in there, like Maxwell is just one of them.
Yeah.
Well, Al Rosen.
Well, Dallas Green.
Dallas, that's right.
Who's not there right at the moment, but will probably be back somewhere.
He'll pop up somewhere, I'm sure.
And Jim Frye just recently.
That's right. Who'd they pick up today? They got rid of Lee Smith.
Yeah, they got the two pitchers from the Red Sox, Schiraldi and Nipper, who's from the St. Louis.
Yeah, I know that. And Al might blossom there, and Schiraldi might become the reliever or a starter.
Yeah, Schiraldi's got good stuff.
He does. He's had poor success with it.
Well, one thing about the Cubs, when you're taking over the Cubs at a time like this, and whatever you do, you can't be too bad because they're not very good anyway.
That's right. You can only go up, I believe. And Smith, they may be smart. Smith may be toward the end of his greatest effectiveness.
Smith is used a great deal, and you can't use a man that much, really. I'll tell you what happens to him. Really, toward the end of each season, you can see Smith begin to fade a little bit.
That's right.
But he has been and probably still is an outstanding relief pitcher. He's the old power type pitcher.
That's right. And the Gossage.
You know what you're going to get from him, and you just have to try to be ready to hit it, and most of the time you can.
Yep.
Worrell's pretty much the same thing.
Very much.
The only thing is he's got his slider supplements his fastball.
Yeah, Gossage has a slider too. I complained with him in San Diego, he never used his slider half enough.
Yeah.
You can't come in there with that hard one all the time without somebody meeting it smack.
Well, particularly when probably without you even realizing it, something goes off of it after a few years.
Oh, sure.
And it doesn't take much to go off of it.
No, that's right. Brings them down to the more ordinary level.
Yeah.
What do you think about the rise of the Giants under Craig and Rosen?
Well, I think it's obviously dramatic, you know, after a lot of years when nothing seemed to work. Craig obviously has done a good job, and he's certainly an expert in pitchers. Rosen, I've known Rosen for years, and they obviously did a good job. What else can you say? I think that there's a little question anymore that it's... And there's probably a lot of reasons, and maybe no one specific reason, but it's pretty tough to repeat.
Yeah.
And the big reason is there's nobody really dominant. You don't have any great clubs anymore.
There are no dynasties.
No dynasties. Talk about the old Dodgers, the old Yankees, maybe even the old Cardinals.
Or the Reds.
Or the Reds. They just don't happen. And the rules have changed enough to make it impossible to put together a so-called dynasty. I was always interested in the term dynasty. People like to say, well, the Tigers 3 years ago. Look, they're going to be a dynasty. Well, the real truth of the matter is, if you read history as I read it, a dynasty doesn't, it's after it's over. And you look back and you say, that was a dynasty.
Yeah.
You can't predict dynasty.
You recognize it for what it was,
not
for what it's going to be.
Yeah.
That's so true. And I guess the free agency and so forth has made it harder for a team to keep its set lineup year after year, which you could do in the old days.
That's right.
If you wanted to.
Yeah, all the rules have moved in that direction, and all of it really revolving around the collective bargaining agreement.
That's right.
Arbitration. Yeah, that's when they talk about the increase in salaries, they keep talking about free agency. The real truth of the matter is arbitration may have as much to do with it as free agency.
Absolutely. That's all the players I talk with think that they have certain definite opinions. They all, almost all, are against the DH. But a few, and Marty Marion is one that says, I like the DH. I don't like seeing an old pitcher go up there and hack around three times and sit down and so forth. But most of them are against the DH.
I think the biggest thing about the DH is not the question of whether you care whether there's another hitter in the lineup and whether it bothers you that the pitchers can't hit, and so it's a dead spot in the lineup. I think the most interesting question is really, and I don't care, I'll tell you the truth, I could live with either one of them, wouldn't make any difference. But the biggest difference is the question that you don't have the same strategic input from a manager with a pitcher. You know, do I pinch hit? Do I bunt? Do I do what? And the real truth of the matter is the fans, what they really enjoy as much is, and one thing about baseball, one of the big things about baseball, it's all out there in the open where they can see it. And you don't have to really be an expert to think you're an expert. And so you can sit in the stands and decide what you'd do if you were the manager, why did you do that? And I think the more things you can give the fans to, in effect, become a
part of it,
a manager
just
on their own,
yeah,
participant, the better off you are.
Yeah. That's a good point. And beyond that, it can't go on forever, I don't think, with one league using the DH and the other one.
It shouldn't, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. It's even bad enough in a sense that the American League's got 14 teams and the National 12. Yeah. What do you think about expansion?
Well, it's going to happen. And I'm guessing now it's going to happen. They've been saying this for several years. I would guess now I guess by the passage of time, that's obviously it should be closer than it was 5-10 years ago.
Well, sure.
I think it'll happen the next 2 or 3 years. I think probably when they set it up, they'll do it on a timetable basis, much like the NBA has, where they'll expand to certain cities and give them 2 or 3 years to get their act together.
Yeah. Would you think that the first expansion would probably logically be the National League adding a couple teams to
Logically, but the American League might not agree with that. You know, the American League might decide to go its own route, and if there's, what are there out there, four plums, so-called, in the cities? I don't know.
Or at least...
But the American League might decide they don't want to get left by the wayside. Now, whether the commissioner can completely control that or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Logically, the National League should expand next to get, as you say, to 14 teams. But then you're going to have the National League having that same unbalanced schedule that the American League has. So you really need to get... There's even been some rumor that they'll go ahead and expand to 16. Six teams.
I know.
And then that would go to 2 and 4 and would give you an even number, and you could have a balanced schedule again. If they did that, I'd say they certainly have to do that on a staggered base homework.
Somebody, I can't remember when,
yeah,
I turned the tape over and didn't push both buttons and lost the whole second side, which ruined my conversation with him. He's not in the book as a result of that. This fellow is proposing that they go to 16 teams in each league and create 4 leagues of 8 teams each and make them more geographically compact and save enormous sums on the travel.
There's no doubt that that's a good idea.
And the rivalries between the Cubs and the White Sox and Milwaukee and so forth and other teams.
Kansas City and St. Louis.
Yeah, that's right.
There's no doubt that's the right way to go. But getting enough people to agree that it's the right way to go to get a vote for it,
I don't think it'll happen.
No.
I'm worried that even if it's 10 years before they go to 16 teams in each league or longer, how much they're going to water down the quality of play in the major leagues.
Well, the quality of play in the major leagues has probably already been watered down. Obviously, be watered down more.
Yeah.
But the attendance is... Parity is closer. You know, there's still some have-nots and some haves, but there's no big dominance, as I said.
That's right.
And the truth of the matter is, the fans, I don't really think, care that much.
There you go.
They're interested in the stars, the glamour.
Yeah.
And when you get below those superstars, or maybe even stars,
yeah,
to the most of the ball players who are good major league ball players or average players,
but journeymen
to an extent.
Yeah.
They don't really care. They're part of what the fans see as their team.
Yeah.
Remember, they don't have to live in a city. Yeah. They have a team that they follow.
Right.
And television has, of course, brought that about.
Sure.
Where everybody can become an expert everywhere now. They're a fan of somebody everywhere. I just don't think that that's a key factor. It'll happen. It'll be watered down. I don't think the fans care. I don't think, even though there's a lot written about it, and the fan may even say, yeah, it's not the same quality it used to be. But then you go out to the games and root and get excited and be happy or angry, whichever the case is, with what his team does.
Right. I agree. Would you agree that expansion made less impact on quality as it came along up to this point by virtue of the acceptance of blacks and the influx of Hispanics?
That's probably true.
Yeah. Without all of those guys, it would have been a bigger decrease in the quality.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Any special thoughts about being a general manager and problems?
Well, I guess the most memorable thoughts are the fact that I was very fortunate in having been born in the community, brought up in the community, played sports in the community, and eventually become general manager of the team that I, in the community that I had rooted for all my life. That's unusual.
True.
I learned to transfer my abilities, whatever they may have been, and my loyalties. When I went to San Francisco or Montreal and the Mets, I can do that. I can live with it. Although, when I think back, I'm going to tell you the happiest time of my life, oddly enough. I'm going to tell you where it was. It was in Rochester, New York.
That's great.
6 years as general manager of AAA team, which was even more important then than it is now.
Oh, yes. Oh,
Rochester was a thrive, not only a fine community, had bad winters, incidentally.
Yeah.
Fine community, but a great baseball team. And they had great memories of baseball memories, just like a major league city. They remembered things that happened back in the Little World Series.
I agree.
They remembered their stars. And we drew 500,000 people up there the first year I was there in 1949. We were in the playoffs every year. We won the Little World Series 1 year.
Yeah.
It was, and it was, our family was growing up at the time, so we had children of all ages and in schools and so forth. And the community was, it was so easy to become a part. It's one of it's a community that I found that was the easiest to become a part of coming from the outside.
Yeah.
And somehow or other, those years were the happiest I've had, even though obviously they weren't as meaningful or as important or as satisfactory from a remuneration standpoint as when you came to the big league.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Any other general managers that you particularly admired or thought did a great job?
Well, yeah, Bavese. I always thought was good. Sometimes Bavese was an actor. He put on a little act of what he was doing.
Yeah.
But he was always honest, straightforward. Whatever he said he'd do, he'd do.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one that I had a great rapport with. And I think he contributed a great deal to baseball. And he was a maverick, no questions asked. Charlie Finley.
I agree.
I dealt with Charlie Finley a lot. And in those days, you could deal a lot more in agreeing to things that weren't written. I think now it's become work of their things are checked much more closely. Everything's in the contract. You can't make all of these agreements about a player to be named later and name who he is. Charlie Finley, a lot of people criticize Charlie Finley. Every deal, any dealing I had with Charlie Finley, he always did anything he said he would do. Everything he said he would do.
That's wonderful. And he was ahead of his time and a lot of ideas that he proposed that have become a standard part of the game. Night games and World Series, he was the first one that proposed those. What about your friend that you replaced, Frank Lane?
Well, I learned a great deal from Frank Lane. And Frank Lane taught me from working with him that you don't worry if you make a bad deal, forget about it. But like a ball player has to forget about a bad day. And ball players learn this when he plays 162 games in a season, which makes that game so much different from all other games when you play every day.
Yeah.
But he taught me he'd make a deal, and it didn't worry him 1 minute. If the deal didn't work out, in fact, it's almost like they talk about a pilot of an airplane. If you have a crash or a near crash, you better get back in a plane and take off immediately so that you don't let it affect your emotions and your stability and your future. And I think Frank did make some deals just to be making deals. And I always tried not to do that. But he did teach me that you don't let it get, don't worry. You're gonna make some bad, if you make enough deals, you're going to make some bad deals. But if you don't make any deals, you'll never make a good deal either.
That's right.
And I learned that from Frank Lane, and it was very invaluable to me. I have the feeling that if I hadn't been with Frank Lane for 2 years, I might have been a very, what's the proper word, conservative,
almost timid.
Timid general manager.
Yeah.
But having been with Frank Lane for 2 years, I found out I was.
You had to go out on the limb now and then.
You had to take a shot, take your chances, and you do what you do. I think I try to make more deals with a lot more input from my people.
Uh-huh.
I think Frank was tendency to jump out.
He was a loner.
Yeah, that's right. Whatever he wanted to do, or maybe he and his manager wanted to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you an interesting story about Frank Lane. I don't know if I have anything to do with what you're writing. Dick Meyer was the liaison. I've mentioned his name several times. He was the president of Anheuser-Busch under Mr. Busch, who was the chief executive officer as chairman. And Dick was my liaison with Anheuser-Busch. When you couldn't get to Mr. Busch, you'd get to Dick, and he'd either give you an answer or he'd get you an answer,
yeah,
which was very important.
Of course.
On this, when Frank Lane was there, I don't think Dick ever completely, Frank Lane didn't completely fit what Dick Meyer thought the general manager should be. But they got along and Dick worked it out with him. But I remember a night when, and you'll remember the deal, when Frank Lane and Dick Meyer and I were out in the ballpark together in Old Sportsman's Park, and Frank was talking and trying to convince everybody, maybe including himself, that a deal he wanted to make was a good deal. And it was Bill Verdon to Pittsburgh for Dick Littlefield and Bobby Del Greco. Do you remember the deal?
I do.
Okay. And one of the aspects of the deal he kept talking about during the course of the evening at the ball game and after the game was, Verdon's got problems with his eyes. He can't see. He can't see. He won't be able to see down the line. Frank was, I don't think, adverse to making these kind of deals where he thought he was putting something over on somebody. I never thought I could do that or wanted to do it or would have done it.
Yeah.
And I don't think he was right, incidentally. Verdon did have bad eyesight, but it didn't affect his hitting before then or later.
That's right.
So as we left the ballpark, he had talked all evening, and I'd had my input, little, whatever little it was, because I was Frank's assistant. I was trying to be loyal accordingly. We arrived at the door to the office, and Dick Meyer said, well, I'm going to my car, and I'm going home. We said, well, we're going back up the office and check whatever we checked after the ball game. And Frank Lane said, well, what about this deal? Because Frank didn't like that, but in theory, Bush had to approve deals like that.
Yeah.
So Dick said, look, if you like the deal as much as you obviously like it, I'm not going to stand in your way, but let me talk to Mr. Bush in the morning and tell him what you want to do and make sure he at least knows about it before you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we all left. They went to his car, we went upstairs, and we left. 7 o'clock in the morning in this very house in the back room, the phone's ringing. And I pick up the phone, that's Dick Meyer, who was an earlier riser than I was. Dick said, I guess I've awakened you, but he said, I got to ask you a question. He said, what went on at the ballpark last night when we last left? You were with us. What was said? What did I say? I said, well, my memory is you told Frank, well, if you want to make the deal, I don't know that I like it, but I'm not going to stand in your way. You're the general manager. Let me talk to Mr. Bush about it and at least let him know and give him a chance to say anything if he wants to say it. Dick says, that's what I thought I said. But he said, you haven't had the radio on yet, but turn on the radio because that deal's been made. It's already announced.
He did. In his first years with Padres, trader Jack McKeon was a little bit like Trader Lane, I think. He was swinging deals every 5 minutes.
Okay, another thing. You see, these kind of people are pretty smart. Frank was smart. The Cardinals had been down. They hadn't been winning under the first half dozen years or first several years of the Brewery ownership. And he knew that he couldn't be worse and he might be better. Just like the deal he made with Lee Smith.
Yeah.
Lee Smith's a heck of a pitcher for the Cubs. But they haven't done anything. So what do they got to lose? McKeon came in. Those are ideal situations under which to come in.
You can't really lose.
That's you can't true. Lose. Yeah. You go ahead and kind of shuffle the cards. And first place, any deal you make, you got to be lucky too. Nobody's all that smart about the human being.
That's right.
And so if you make enough deals that make a little sense, some of them you're going to get lucky and they're going to be good. Maybe there'll be one that you didn't think was the best will turn out to be the best.
That's right. And some people just seem to run in luck, like Rosen is at the moment. And
you got a hot streak. It's just about like a ball player.
Right.
You're in a hot streak.
This guy at Pittsburgh, Sid Thrift.
Yeah. Well, Sid Thrift, couldn't do anything bad with Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Now the test comes when you finally get to the point where you're pretty good, you got a chance to go be better. What happens then?
Yeah, right. Interesting. Well, it's
I'll tell you another fellow I've always admired. And a lot of people don't. If I worked for him, I might have a problem. I don't know. I don't think I would. But I don't think. It's George Steinbrenner. I happen to like George Steinbrenner.
He's got his points. He's a little bit, in my book, like Charlie Finley. He's his own man, and he's in control of the situation.
They both own their team.
Yeah.
And the real truth of the matter is, when they own the team, they can do what they want. And I'm going to tell you the truth, that there's no question in my mind. There's a lot of general owners down through the years. I've heard somebody say, oh, they don't care whether they win or not. Goodwill, St. Louis, they'll say that. They don't care if he wins in football.
It's not true. I never saw an owner that didn't want to win. Now, he may go about winning in a different way than you think you would or you or he should, but he really wants to win, particularly if he's never won. He wants that World Series ring or the Super Bowl ring on his finger.
You know,
he wants to be looked upon as better than his peers. And anybody that thinks that those people don't care and say, well, okay, I'm getting a lot of money, I'm making money, I've got big income, financially I have no problem, don't care if they don't win, that's not true.
Of course, owners are a different breed now from back in the days when you first started, like Braden and Navin and on and on.
They're a different breed, but I guess really the executives and corporations are different breeds. You know, times have changed.
Sure have. Yeah. All right. You've certainly put together a career that was not dull.
No, that's true. It certainly wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, thrill a minute. I learned how to, as I say, how to make deals from Frank Lane. I learned how to live with all this. You know, you do the best you can, and you make the moves you think are good. If they work, fine. If they don't, go and look another direction and do something else.
That's right.
I guess really that's the story of my career when you get right down to it, from St. Louis to New York to St. Louis to San Francisco to Montreal to the football Cardinals to the Steamers.
Right. Well, I always say that there are three things that ought to make a man really content with life, and that's good health, which I've been blessed with and looks like you have too. A mate, a happy marriage with a wonderful mate, and a job that you enjoy doing.
Well, that's important. That really is important.
You got those things.
There's an awful lot of people that have to do what they're doing but don't like it.
I've met so many people that are just absolutely beside themselves about the job they have to do.
And they always want to change careers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's not bad to change jobs, but changing careers is difficult.
That's different. Is Bidwell really leaving?
I can't answer that. Bidwell was a very private person. I worked for him for 5 years and found out that there's only three people that have a great input, that are important in the picture of what Bill Bidwell does. And that's Bill Bidwell himself and Tom Guilfoyle, his attorney, and Nancy Bidwell, his wife. And there's nobody outside of a group, I think, that has input to talk him into anything or out of anything. My opinion, I did not think Bill was leaving up till the last 6 months. And then the way things have developed here with the stadium picture and his activity, I've begun to slip. I begin to think maybe he is. I don't think he wants to leave. But I think he'd like to have somebody give him some reason not to leave. But whether that's still left here to do for him, I don't know. I think he'd like to stay.
As an outsider, relatively, I can't know all of the ins and outs. But if he hasn't been able to fill Busch Stadium for the last few years, his reason for wanting a bigger place is not too convincing.
Well, except that if he were to win, first place Busch Stadium really is, from the standpoint of seating is not ideal.
Yeah, I know
the worst seats. When you get to the 40,000, 50,000 seats in the stadium, it's not good for football. It's not bad for baseball, it's not good for football.
Yeah.
But there's another item here, too. There's two points to this, as I see it. Number one, if he ever has, and I can't tell you whether he will or won't, but I think the chances are, if he goes on long enough, he'll probably put a contending team on the field, because, again, the luck of the draw may bring that around somewhere. Not because he's good or bad, but just the fact that luck will take over. Secondly, if he does have such a team, and even had some playoff games in here, even though it'd be in January and bad, probably theoretically bad weather, he would definitely have a chance to, and probably fill the stadium and more than fill it, whether it was 50 or 70.
Right.
Also, he'd have a different type of seat to sell. He'd have those good luxury boxes to sell, which is very important to football. And the next thing that Bill would have to do, if he gets to a stadium of that type, and this applies to any city he goes to with a stadium of 70 or 80,000, he's got to change his approach to marketing. Bill will just not market. He doesn't believe in it. He hasn't believed in it. When I was there, I thought he wanted me to lead him in that direction, and I discovered he didn't. It really agitated him to have me push him into talking about various marketing projects.
Sure.
He's going to have to change his approach to that, and he may. I don't know. It's hard to change the spots.
He's a little far along down the line to be changed.
I agree with that. But
If he goes to another city where it has an 80,000 seat stadium, obviously there'll be a period of time when they're going to make guarantees to him, and there'll things be done to probably guarantee him, if not the capacity, the equivalent of the capacity, yeah, not financially. But somewhere down the line, that won't last if you don't do something about it. And whether what he'll do about it, or whether he'll do anything about it as time goes on, I don't know.
A lot of people think he ought to get rid of his... Who's the guy that does the draft?
Jordan Boone.
Yeah.
Boone. Well, I think... See, Bill is such an important part of the organization. Nobody really does anything for Bill Bidwell that he can say, well, I ought to fire that guy because he's doing a bad job. Because Bill Bidwell controls everything. See, Tom Guilfoyle once told me, and he's told Bill Bidwell too, his lawyer, his attorney, yeah, who's a very smart man. He once told me and told Bill, look, you've got to do one of two things. You've got to either run the organization completely and not let anybody think that you're not running it, and let everybody know you're responsible for every phase of the operation. Nobody else is fully responsible. Either you do that, or you go hire a general manager whom you give a contract to for 3 or 4 or 5 years and say, okay, it's your baby. You do what you want to do, with maybe some limitations when we get the big financial questions. You do what you want to do to build a team. I'm going to go get an office out in Clayton. And if you don't do the job in 3 years, you're gone. And let him do it and see what happens.
Yeah.
He's never seen fit to do it that way. So he's done it the other way, and it hasn't worked up to this point. At least it hasn't worked from the standpoint of winning or losing, or drawing a lot of people.
No. When his father moved from Chicago here, what was his main reason?
I think the Bears, the fact there were two football teams up there, the Bears and the Cardinals, and he had a chance to get out from under that kind of competition and have a city of his own.
Yeah,
but you know, that's not his natural father. You know that too, don't you?
No, I didn't know that.
No. Bill Bidwell, come here. I'll be there in a minute. I'll be there in a minute. Bill Bidwell and his brother, Starmy Bidwell, who owned Sportsman's Park, the racetrack in Chicago.
Yes.
And both owned the club together here, and then one Bill bought out his brother because they really didn't get along.
Mm-hmm.
They were both adopted separately. They're not brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not know that they were adopted until there was some kind of a suit involving the widow and the owner and so forth.
About how old were they when they learned that?
How old were the Bidwells when they learned that they were adopted?
I couldn't say for sure.
Well, they were grown young men. They weren't children, as I recall the story.
I don't know. If it came out of the lawsuit, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. That's my daughter, Jane. Jane Pilkey.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Nice
to meet you.
Is that your little one hopping around here? Uh-huh. Well, he's a live wire.
Yep.
Yeah, like lots of them are at that age.
Uh-huh.
Well, real good, Bing. How'd you get the name Bing?
I had an aunt, they tell me, that lived with us when I was in Oakland as a very young child,
mm-hmm,
growing up, and they say that she called me a binger because I threw everything and made a lot of noise, and she referred to me as a binger, and that was later contracted to Bing. That's the story I get.
Reasonable.
My mother's sister.
Yeah.
And when I went to high school, University City. We moved to University City. I went to University City High School. I didn't bring along the nickname Bing. I didn't tell people I'm Bing. My name was Vaughn, and I signed it Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, like Archie Vaughn.
Yeah.
And that was my first name, a family name. And I went as Vaughn. Everybody called me Vaughn in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out of high school, went to Washington and began to play some sports to the point where once in a while was written about. There was a sports writer at the Star, Old Star Times, by the name of Ray Gillespie. And Ray Gillespie wrote quite a bit of basketball and wrote about me.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a headline one day, I remember distinctly, said, Vaughn Devine does this for whatever semi-pro team it was at the time.
Yeah.
Scores 20 points.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that name, what's it, can't we get, don't you have another name? That name just doesn't fit. I said, well, you know, I was known as Bing Devine. He said, that's good, Bing, let's use that. And this is about the time that I was getting out of college and going into semi-pro ball, and my runner office boy worked with the Cardinals.
Yeah.
So I suddenly transferred to Bing, and the further I went along in baseball, the more easier it was to refer to me as Bing and Vaughn, and I got to the point where most people didn't know my name was Vaughn. And my mother, I think, was very happy when we got away from Bing Devon, because it was a family name.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure she ever fully accepted the fact that we went back. I went to Bing eventually somewhere along the
way. Well, it's a neat nickname.
Yeah, it's been good.
It's good. I don't know how Bing Crosby got his, but...
I don't know either. And then there was another divine, not a Bing divine, but another divine that often was referred to in my early days, because he was very active then as an actor, Andy Devine. Remember Andy?
Oh, sure. Good old Andy. Well, I've taken enough of your time, and I appreciate it.
The ballplayer I know of was Archie Bowen, as I say.
Yeah, Archie. And
incidentally, my mother's still alive at 104.
You're kidding.
104 and a half, tell you the truth. She's out of Marie de Villa, out of Clayton Road.
Good gracious. I'm approaching next June, I'll hit the big 80.
I figured you told me about when you graduated from school.
On my father's side, we were a pretty long living bunch. He died at 82, and my grandfather was older than that, and grandmother likewise, so maybe it's not surprising that I've made it. But
Well, my dad's father will live to 93, and my all my mother's sisters live to 80s, 90s. Mm-hmm. Let me go get the book on deals. I still want to look just
all
for
right.
satisfaction on the age you did.
All right.
Beaver was, they set up a plan whereby there would be a pool, a drawing. Every club that was willing to pay Seaver the same thing he had already signed a contract for from the Braves,
mm-hmm.
would go into this drawing. But they had to be willing to accept that. And it was like $40,000, $50,000, which nowadays is nothing. Yeah. Then was still considered something.
Pretty big then.
And so I tried, told George, I had brought a scout with me from the Cardinals by the name of Nelson Berberick from the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
who liked Seaver excessively.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to George after Berberick came with us, and I said, look, Berberick likes this pitcher, and we'd like to go into this drawing. It'll cost us $50,000, we know, and I'd like your approval. George said, geez, $50,000 for Seaver, a free agent pitcher? He said, let me see the reports on it. And I went and got Berberick's reports, the reports he put in when he was with the Cardinals and the reports he put in after he came with the Mets, just a six-month period of difference. He said, how can you give it? He said, look at here. In 6 months ago, Nelson Berberick wrote a report to the Cardinals where he said he would give Seaver $15,000. And he said 6 months later, he writes a report that he'd give him $35,000. How can he change that much from 15 to 35 in that period of time? Well, it doesn't bother me, but it bothered him.
Yeah.
And he said, now you want to give him 50. He said, I can't approve that. Well, we debated it back and forth for about 10 days, however long we had to make the decision.
Yeah.
I kept telling myself, this is one I'm going to have to go to Don Grant. In fact, I think I mentioned it to Don Grant. He said, well, see if you can work it out. No, we hope we don't have to get into this. Well, finally, at the last minute, George says, all right, okay, you want to go into the, go ahead and put our name in. And I think he really thought, well, there'll be enough clubs go in.
We won't get
him anyway. Well, there are only three clubs went into the drawing for Tom Seaver. Believe it or not.
Who are they?
They were, as I recall, they were Baltimore, Cleveland, and ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And so we got, we called on the phone. Lee McPhail was at the time the deputy commissioner or something like that.
Yeah.
He called and said, well, you got the rights to Seaver. Now I'm going to tell you the final fact. I called Nelson Berberick on the West Coast. I said, we've gotten Tom Seaver. Go on up to Fresno and get together with him and sign him to a Mets contract. So now I said, here's the deal. Here's what Atlanta gave him by the commissioner's office, and that's what we're supposed to give. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing less. Gets up. A day later, he calls me, said, I'm going to pay for them. I've just left the Seaver house, and they want more money. I said, no, wait a minute. I said, and I realized the chances are, if he wanted to make a case of it, he could have made a case. You couldn't hold him to a deal that had been already.
That's true. Okay. That's true.
So I said, I cannot go back to George Weisdahl and tell him it's going to cost more.
No way.
I said, what do you think we can do? He said, well, I'll tell you, I got a little idea for talking to him. I think the big problem is Seaver does not want to go down and pitch at the lower level. He wants to go out and pitch triple-A ball. So he said, I think if I can go up and tell him we'll sign him to a Jacksonville contract and guarantee him we'll pitch him in Jacksonville, which was our triple-A club at the time, I think we can get it. I said, go on back and do it. What difference does it make? We're not that good anywhere. So he said, whoever it is, if we think he's good enough, we won. So he went back and he got him on that basis. Well, the interesting thing is, if you go look at the record book, Seaver was a pretty good pitcher in Jacksonville.
He probably could have pitched right with the Mets at that point.
Very likely.
So yeah. That's one of those cases, incidentally, where you were lucky and you didn't act like you knew everything. You just said, well, whatever we have to do, we'll do.
Right.
That was probably the biggest.
Did they bring in Kuzman at the same time while you were there?
Yeah, Kuzman was another story. And the story of Joe McDonald was my assistant as the farm director. We had a player by the name of Jerry Kuzman who had borrowed some money from us. When I say borrowed money, it was like $600 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Joe McDonald came to me and said, Kuzman, those are $600 and we want to release him from whatever level he was, Allentown or somewhere. He said, we know that our people don't like him and want to release him. But he said, I've always had a problem here releasing ball players. If George Weiss finds, any time I release a player, George gets mad at me if he owes us money. We have to write it off.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'd like to keep Kuzman until we get the $600 back from his salary over a period of 6 weeks or so.
Yeah.
And then I don't have to tell George that we've got a poor little rubber player who owes us money. I said, fine, go ahead and do it, but he won't say anything to anybody. And that's how we kept Kuzman and how he came to the big league. We were going to release him.
Fantastic.
Now, if you tell all those are the kind of stories that prove that nobody's all that smart.
Nobody. Right.
You know, there's the two of the main pitchers with the club when they won their pennants in 59, in 69, and the chance that neither one of them would have been with them if you'd have followed your normal course of events. Yeah.
How about Nolan Ryan? Had you gotten him?
I was involved in that.
Yeah.
I was double checking the top level free agents for the Mets.
Mm-hmm.
The story about George, it's just like I told you. I think George was happy to have me get out of his hair and go travel around the country and see ball players. And so I said, well, one of the things I'll do, since the big thing we're trying to do is acquire talent, is I'll go out, get a report from all the scouts, and I'll go out and try and see each one of the scouts' top players so that I can compare. The scout can mostly compare players in his own territory. I'll be able to compare them all over.
Yeah.
So I went out on this trip, and one of the places I was going to was Texas. And to visit Red Murph was the scout, mm-hmm. and see Nolan Ryan. And I went out on a gray day in the spring, where Murph picked me up at an airport, drove me out of this field, a skinned field on the side of a hill, really, at a high school, a country high school. And here's Nolan Ryan, and he's really high, building this guy. Boy, when you see this guy pitch. Nolan Ryan went out that day and had a day where not only did his team make errors, and these were bad high school players. Mm-hmm. Not only did they make errors, but they didn't even walk. They were hitting the ball. Bad high school players were facing Ryan and making contact with the ball. When we left, it was a bad game, and Ryan was bad. And we left, and Murph was pretty near in tears. Murph was extremely jealous of his scouting reports and his players.
Yeah.
He said, oh, Jesus, how can anything like this happen? He said, the one day you get in here, this guy's bad. He said, I know I can't draft him now. I said, why not? He said, well, if you look at the report you'll put in. I said, look, I'm smart enough to already have found out that nobody knows everything.
And one game
doesn't. One game doesn't. Yeah. You've seen Ryan over a period of time. You like him. You go ahead and put in your report exactly like you want to. Now, I can't put in a report and verify it, but I won't negate it.
Yeah,
I'll let it go on the basis of what you say. Now, we still didn't draft Ryan high. You know, he wasn't drafted until about the fifth round.
Hmm.
I mean, again, to show you how much does everybody know about it.
That's right.
So, in fact, Ryan and I, just this last fall, winter, when he was in here, we talked about this story. I happened to run into him at the hotel, and we talked about this story. Now, I was going to tell you one more. I'll tell you another one on the other side of the ledger.
Yeah.
Whatever year it was, you'd have to check the book to see, but 65 or 6, one of my first 2 years with the Mets, one of these players I saw on my trips traveling around the scouts was, of all people, Reggie Jackson, playing for Arizona State.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was obviously good, if not great. And I went on to I made my trip, and I went to the West Coast, and I saw a catcher in a small high school 50 miles north of Los Angeles by the name of Steve Chilcott. And we had no catchers in the organization. Mm-hmm. And we even took Casey from, during the day, we had him make a trip with us up to this field to see this high school catcher, Chilcott. Well, Chilcott got about 7 hits in the doubleheader. And when we left, you know, Casey in his inimitable way said something about it. He said, how do you like Chilcott? He said, well, you know, 7 for 7, well, how can you not like him? You know, who's bad at 7 for 7? So the end result of this whole thing is we had the first draft in the whole country. Because we've been all that bad.
Sure.
We drafted Chilcott instead of Reggie Jackson. Jackson was the second player drafted.
That whole Arizona State team was good then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I've always, people